So welcome, everyone, to our Hanukkah class 5785. It's hard to believe we're in 5785. 2024, we're almost in 2025. And tonight's class is in honor of the fourth yahrzeit of my Rebbetzin Rachel's late father, Rabbi Pinchas Klar, Zichron of Rachel, blessed memory. And the class is titled, I Rise Because I Fall. And the whole concept of this is from the great Mir Rosh Hashiva, Rabbi Chaim Shmulevitz, who was Rebbe among a couple of Rebbes that my late father-in-law had that he adored, Rabbi Shmulevitz. At the Mir, my father-in-law, we became very close with him. And in fact, some of the, what they call the famous Musser Shmuzin, when Rabbi Shmulevitz would give on Shabbat, the end of Shabbos, he'd give these incredible Torah talks with powerful messages. But the guys couldn't write anything down. They couldn't record anything. So you had to have a couple of the guys, or two or three guys, who were blessed with great memories. And as soon as Shabbos was over, they would have to go write down and transcribe everything in a book, and it became something of legacy. But I have to tell you, they weren't always 100% correct. And I remember a few times when I would say over something, Rabbi Shmulevitz's name, my late father-in-law, Zichron Levracha, would sort of correct me and say, David, he said, it was almost like that, but it wasn't quite like that. So he actually was privileged to hear it from the Rosh Hashiva himself. So tonight, here is the thematic element. I rise because I fall. Meaning that if I wouldn't fall, ostensibly, I would not rise. What would that mean? So I want to address it from the terms of or b'choshech, light and darkness. Many people call Hanukkah the Chag HaUrim, the festival of lights. And it is a festival of lights, although we can't really match our non-Jewish neighbors, right? Again, this is a little sacrilegious, but there was a movie with Chevy Chase a bunch of years ago. I won't mention its name, but it has the word vacation in it. And it's not a great movie, but there's a three-minute scene that is hysterically funny where he has around, I don't know, 200,000 little of the little lights that are strung all around his house and his bush. I mean, almost no exaggeration. And apparently when one of the circuits are faulty, if one of them is faulty, the whole line doesn't work. And so for the first half of the show, I guess he's struggling because he can't get it to light up. And he doesn't know that in his basement there's like a power switch, like a circuit breaker that had been off. And it had nothing to do with the light. So he's changed every light bulb and he's frustrated. And there's this hilarious scene where he doesn't even know it's lit up. And then someone, like his grandma or someone in the house, just flips the switch and they all come on simultaneously. And it becomes, in the middle of the night, like the sun just came out. The neighbors are, you know, like everyone is woken up. And then in the far hills of Los Angeles, you see a rolling blackout because of the power draw in that one moment. And of course, Chevy is oblivious to it all. So if it's in terms of sheer quantity, we're not really going to measure up. But let's talk about Or and Choshech in terms of the season. So I know this is typically Jewish of me. Go to source 5. Well, come on, I didn't write them here to have fun. I mean, it's Hanukkah. So have a look at source 5. It is such a part of nature and our world, this Choshech or mysterious sort of, there's this tension between the two, that it literally, in this time of Adam HaRishon, of the first man, became an issue. Now remember, Adam leaves the garden after Rosh Hashanah time. So Rosh Hashanah normally is in, you know, September-ish. Okay? This year was a little later, can be a little earlier, September-ish. So he is brought into the world. They say Hayom Harat Olam, that Rosh Hashanah is the birthday of Adam. And he experiences his first world experience post-Rosh Hashanah. And what happens in our world post-Rosh Hashanah? The days incrementally get shorter and shorter in terms of daylight. And then just this past Shabbat, we had something called the equinox, right? The winter solstice, where we have the shortest day in terms of daylight, and then it reverses and the light comes back. The problem for Adam is Adam had never experienced our world. This was new to him. So he saw the light start to go away. And he was devastated because he knew that as a result of the sin, when they ate from the eighth sadas, the tree of knowledge, that he and Chava brought Misa, death, into our world. And he erroneously believed, because of his lack of experience, that what was happening with the light getting less and less each day was as a cause and effect. Cause was his sin, the effect was the world was literally being extinguished. And so he lamented his loss, and it was impactful to the point where he was sorrowful. But then something happened. So let's look at source 5. This is all from the Talmud, Tractate Avodah Zarah. Said Rabbi Hanan bar Rabba, Kalenda is kept on the 8 days following the winter equinox, Saturnalia on the 8 days preceding the equinox. Now, just as a sidelight, this is totally not relevant to what we're going to discuss. What holiday came as a result of Saturnalia generations later? What holiday was predated by Saturnalia, and that, I'll give you a hint, the church wanted to bring new recruits in, so what they did is they amalgamated the festival that they were observing today and last night at this time of year specifically, even though I believe in the New Testament, the birth is supposed to be in a different season totally. Spring, thank you. So the shift was in order to perhaps bring the pagans who were looking for something real, meaningful, in the Catholic fold. So the Roman Catholic Church based it on Saturnalia, which had been a pagan festival, as is alluded to in our source. Fascinating. Okay, let's carry on. Our rabbis taught, when Adam the first man saw the day getting gradually shorter, he said, woe is me, perhaps because I have sinned. The world around me is being darkened and returning to its state of tohu vavohu, chaos and confusion. This then is the kind of death to which I have been sentenced from heaven. And so what did Adam do? He began keeping an 8 days fast. This is really not a Jewish thing. I mean, Adam wasn't Jewish, but Jews never fast for more than one day. Okay. You know, it's a little extraordinary, right? This is not in keeping with Jewish tradition, right? Jewish tradition is always, they hated us. We had a war. We won. Now let's eat. So 8 days is unthinkable that Adam fasted for 8 days. But as he observed the winter equinox or the solstice, and he noted, Adam did, that the day was now getting increasingly longer, Adam said, darkly, hold on. Oh, this, Baruch Hashem, thank God, he said, is the world's course. Meaning, it's not my sin. The world's not dying. It's nature. And he was celebratory. And so what did he do? He set forth to keep an 8 days festivity. So in the following year, he appointed both, Kalenda and Saturnalia, as festivals. Now, Adam fixed them for the sake of heaven, L'shem Shemayim, but the heathens appointed them for the sake of idolatry. So that's a fascinating context into this tension between Choshech and Or, and Or and Choshech, light and darkness, that it even was impactful in the original version of our world with Adam HaRishon, that this time of year is not just simply a metaphorical loss of light, but a literal loss of light. We feel it. People get down, right? They get depressed sometimes, unfortunately, with the lack of light. Just physiologically, it's a reality. So let's go back now to source number one. Just have a little fun here. So where does Hanukkah come from? So we now know that this time of year is, in fact, perfectly suited to a holiday of lights, Hanukkah. So where would the source of Hanukkah be? So you're saying, well, Rabbi Kaplan, come on, we just said the Al HaNisim, the Al HaPurkan. I know the story. It happened, 2,200 years ago. The Maccabees, I know the story. Well, that is a beginning, but like many things in Judaism, there's a concept of ma'aseh avot siman labanim. Sometimes the things that happen to the originators of our people, specifically the patriarchs and matriarchs, was a harbinger for things that would happen to the grandchildren. And in this case, we're dealing with something about Aaron, Aharon HaKohen. So let's look at source one. And this is the beginning of Parshas Bahaloscha, Numbers 8, source one. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to Aaron and say to him, 'When you light the lamps, the seven lamps shall cast their light toward the face of the menorah.'" Bahaloscha Eseneros. And Rashi points out in source two, why is there a juxtaposition, a smichut ha-parshiot, this connection between the last segment, the previous parsha, which is not here for the sake of expediency and paper and ink, dealt with the tribal leaders, the princes, each bringing a special, incredible offering for each day of the consecration of God's home, the Mishkan, the tabernacle. But what tribe was left out? Aaron's tribe. Because Aaron was the first Kohen, he was the first priest. Moshe, of course, Moses was a Levite. And the Levites, they were left out. They were not part of the equation. And it hurt Aharon. It bothered him. He loved the Mishkan. And even though he was a critical component of the Mishkan, of the tabernacle, this is a big issue to him. So look at source 2. When you light, why is the portion dealing with the menorah juxtaposed to the portion dealing with the chieftains, the tribal princes who brought their gifts? For when Aaron saw the dedication offerings of the chieftains, the tribal princes, Aaron felt distressed over not joining them in this dedication. Neither he, the priests, nor his tribe of Levi. So God said to Aaron, "By your life, Aaron, yours, your involvement is greater than their, the prince's involvement." Theirs is temporary. It's a one-time show. Yours is eternal. For you will light and prepare the lamps. You're going to light the menorah. Okay. Strange, though. The priests, the Kohanim, I don't know if we have any Kohanim here. So we're like, yeah, we have Kohanim. Right, of course. Dum bum ba dum bum yum ba da dum bum bum. Thank you. So it's like the joke, and you know, if Ginger wasn't with us, I would say, you know, anybody ever want to be a Kohen? Well, my dad was a Kohen, my grandfather was a Kohen. I need to be a Kohen. Right? We all know that joke. So the Kohanim, the priests, were not only given the great honor, the schut, to light the menorah, but there were other very specific commandments that could only be performed. The avodah, the service of God, was unique to the tribe of Levi, but more specifically to our Kohanim, to the priests. The menorah was just one of them. And in fact, there were others that were even, shall we say, more of a gift. I'll illustrate one. The ketores, the incense. We know that when Moshe was challenged by his cousin Korach for the rights to lead the Jewish people and Aaron to be the Kohen, the challenge, the gambit was thrown down. And it revolved not around who gets to light the menorah, but who gets to burn the incense, the ketores. And it was a death sentence if you weren't the one who was chosen by God, specifically mandated with lighting the and having the ketores, this beautiful reyach, you know, like igniting it and giving it the beautiful smell. If you weren't the one, you're chayiv misa, you're dead. That was the challenge to Korach. So that was unique. So there are a myriad of other things that God could have given to Aaron to be mefayis him, to comfort him, to make him say, "Oh, it's okay. You have unique things too. The princes, beautiful gifts. Aaron, you have many more, so please, don't be worried. It's okay." Why the menorah? So the rabbis, the Ramban, Nachmanides specifically says, this is a shout out, this Rashi, and this moment, to tonight. It's Hanukkah. In other words, it's not just that you as a Kohen are going to light the menorah, true, but even when there isn't a temple, which is going to happen, we're going to be lighting the menorah because of your great-grandchildren, the Hashmonaim, the Maccabees. Your tribe, and specifically your priests, your descendants, are going to bring about this incredible miracle of Hanukkah, and therefore that is the reward. It's not just as long as the temple exists, great. It It's going to go way beyond the confines of the walls of the temple. Aaron, Hanukkah is your historic eternal gift from me to you. So it's beautiful. That was to give Aaron hope and comfort. So therefore we see that the menorah itself, the gift of the menorah and the lighting of the original gold menorah was a defense, if you will, to darkness. That the conception of this included the miracle of Hanukkah. So in other words, you don't understand. It's sort of like the Russian dolls that we have, right? That they're each one is subsumed in the other, right? The little, what are the dolls called again? Thank you, the Matryoshka dolls. That could be on tonight's trivia test. The Matryoshka dolls, right? And they always get the little bubble of Matryoshka that you think, just when there couldn't be another Matryoshka doll, there's always that last one to catch you, right? So that is how history is nested. So in other words, nested within the confines of the gift that God gives uniquely to the priesthood, to Aaron, to Aaron, nested within it is the Hanukkah gift. So it's all part and parcel of the same gift. So it's remarkable. So you see, Adam had to deal with light and darkness and the loss of light in his world. And the menorah is the ultimate expression and the ultimate gift that God gives to Aaron and to the Jewish people as a whole to symbolize this eternal fight with light and darkness. So now we're going to get to the thesis of tonight, which is, I rise because I fall. So have a look at source number 8. Are you ready? This is from the prophet. Number 3, I'm sorry. Sorry, that was a trick. Micah, Micha. One of the Treasar, not a widely disseminated or well-read prophet. Shall we say minor, minor, minor? And in the book of Micah, it has a fantastic quote. Listen to this. I'll read it in Hebrew. It works better in the Hebrew. That's why it's in the Hebrew right in front of you. Al tismichi oyavtili. Do not rejoice over me, my enemy. Kinafalti, though I have nafal, I have fallen. Kamti, I rise. Ki eshev b'choshech, even though I sit in choshech, in darkness, Hashem or li, God is my light. Now there's a teich, there's an explanation of this, makes it even more profound. Ready? Beautiful. Do not rejoice over my enemy, though I have fallen, because I have fallen, that is an impetus for my rise. And although I sit in darkness, God will enlighten me. So if you change the word, tweak it from light to enlighten, then we're going to move into what we're going to discuss from this incredible, very tragic piece of Midrash, oral tradition, source number 4. Before I do, let me contextualize it because it's kind of tough. Okay, here's the context. The Romans, were brought in to Jerusalem by, ironically, bitterly, the great-grandchildren of the Maccabees. See, the great-grandchildren of the Maccabees took two parts for themselves. They were entitled to the priesthood, the kahuna, because they're great-grandchildren of Aaron. That's theirs. But they took something else that wasn't theirs. They took what Judah was given, malchut, the kingship over Israel, and they were not entitled to that. And by amalgamating these two, it was a little bit too much power. It was supposed to be like a, you know, like America has a separation of powers. There was supposed to be a separation of powers amongst the Jews also. And it didn't have a happy ending. Ultimately, they invited the Romans. And as we said at one of our previous classes, for the first 26 years of the Romans coming to Israel, things were okay. They kept their treaties. But then, when they sort of engaged in a history of Jacob and Esau, their ancestors, they realized we don't have to keep our brit. We don't have to keep the covenants with the Jews. And that's when they started to go out and overtly persecute the Jews. Okay. So the Maccabees and the story of the Maccabees ends with Churban, the destruction of the temple in the year 70 with the Romans. So the Romans come to Jerusalem. And they come to the Holy of Holies. But before they can get into the Holy of Holies, They have to go through what's called the Har HaBayit. So when you go to Israel today, any of you visit Israel, the Kotel HaMa'aravi, the Western Wall, is just like an outer retaining wall. It's not, I mean, we love it. It's the holiest place for us to daven. But by the way, you could daven around the other side also. We just don't allow Jewish people to go on the other sides. But within where the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque are, that is the real stuff. That's the part that you dare not go in a state of ritual impurity. And that's why we generally don't go in there. Okay, not just for political reasons, but because of issues with halacha, with Jewish law. Now that said, the Romans come and they really want to go in because they know this is the epicenter for Judaism. And even if they're not really into Judaism, the Romans are interested in the powers of the Jews. I mean, who wouldn't be, you know? We want to control the world. We got to control this little area. But they had an issue. They had seen Raiders of the Lost Ark. They saw the movie. And they saw the end of the movie. And they saw when their great-great-grandchildren, those Nazis, opened up that ark. Right? And Indy is saying to Alan, whatever her name was, right?
Marion,
played by what was the first name of Alan, whatever actress's name was? They'll be on tonight's trivia question. I don't remember. So Karen Allen, that was it, Karen Allen. So he says, don't look at gods, right? And they're looking this way, and then the fire comes out, like, looks like an angel, and then all of a sudden, whoosh, everyone gets burned up, right? So the Romans knew, you don't mess with Hashem, you don't mess with God, okay? We have no belief in this, but we're really scared. So they had Yira. They had Yirah Shamayim. They had fear for heaven. So they said, well, wait a minute. Rather than we go in, let's get a Jew to lead us in. Yeah, but what Jew could they find that would be so treacherous, such a traitor to God, that he would go into the Har HaBayit, to the holy area? It's unbelievable. But they found a guy, and his name was Yosef Mishisa. Yosef Mishisa. And who was Yosef Mishisa? He was this horrific, horrific Jew. And the Romans went to him. They said, hey, Yosef, you don't believe in any of this Jewish stuff, right? He said, no. He said, well, would you go in and honor us, please? The Roman general said, you go in, you know, go beyond that Western Wall. And you know what? Here's a reward for you, Yosef, because you're such a loyal Roman servant. Anything you find in there that you like, it's yours. It's our gift to you. I mean, you're stealing from your own people, but yeah, it's yours. Keep it. So Yosef is such a treacherous individual that he goes in and he comes out with the golden menorah, the menorah that we spoke about with Aaron, lighting as that gift that is Hanukkah. So I deliberately chose this little piece because it's kind of mind-bending that in this little story that we're going to talk about, that the thing he chose was Hanukkah, was that menorah that Aaron had been given. And we said that within the confines of that mitzvah of the menorah was embedded the future holiday of Hanukkah and everything that we celebrate. And that was the thing that Yosef Mishisa chose as his reward. So he comes out with the menorah. Okay, so the Romans look at him and they're shell-shocked. Because even they realize, what? The golden menorah? And they look at this character. I'm just saving you because it's kind of graphic. You can read this yourselves. So they said, the golden menorah? The golden menorah? You're a lowlife, you Jew, Yosef. You go into your own holiest area without a thought. You're not on the level. You're a hedget. You're just some lowlife guy. This is way beyond your pay grade. You did not deserve the golden menorah. It's fitting maybe Caesar, but it ain't for you. Go bring it back, and whatever else you want, you can take it. But not that. Yosef stops. And he realizes, in an instant of light, the clarity of his life, the enormity of his avera, his sin towards God, is right in front of him. He sees it. And in that instant, he realizes who he is and what he's become. And he turns to the Roman general. He says, I will not go back in. So they thought he was kidding. You know, maybe he's doing a Jewish thing, trying to get a better deal. He's haggling a little bit, right? They said, well, what would inspire you to go back? How about we give you 3 years? You can collect all the taxes from Israel, and you just keep them for yourself. Don't even give them to Caesar. That'll be our reward for you. Yeah? Go in. No, not going in. I've angered my creator. I've angered God once. I will not anger him a second time. And they tried to coerce him to no avail. And finally, they took him, and they tortured him to death. And the whole time they were killing him, it was a very slow, horrible, graphic death. The whole time, he was in a process of doing teshuvah, of repentance. And he was crying out to God for the sorrow of who he had become and what he allowed himself, what depths of depravity he had allowed himself to sink to. And in that instant, he went to heaven. He recreated himself. So this is the thesis of Rabbi Chaim Shmulevitz. The reason that Yosef can become a tzaddik, a martyred, righteous individual, is because of his fall. The fall is the instrument that takes and reclaims his soul from the dark side and brings himself back to himself. So when he looked at the Romans and realized that even the Romans are sensitive to something that should be a davar pashut, a simple thing, you don't mess with God and God's temple. How dare I? And they, these heathen, villainous Romans who are about to torture and rape and pillage all of Israel, they are in on it and I'm not even in on it. So that when he had fallen to such a level, Rabbi Shmulevitz says that it's the contrast of the darkness that envelops us that allows us, with the contrast of the dark, to see the little light that emanates forth. And it was the choshech, the darkness that he had self-imposed and created for himself, that in that moment of epiphany, he could see himself for who he was through the eyes of the Romans and bring himself back to himself. And therefore, that verse from Micah, Micho, though I have fallen, I rise. It's because I fall that I rise. It's an unbelievable thing. So we are at a time, since October 7th of last year, where we feel not simply a metaphorical darkness in our world, but a literal darkness. And of course, now we're experiencing both, because we still have tremendous darkness in our world. Things in Europe, we spoke about this even during the davening, how thousands of Jewish people all over Europe are not putting their menorahs in their windows for fear of self-identifying to their neighbors as a Jewish house. We haven't had such a world, I dare say, since the 1930s and Kristallnacht and beyond. And it's real. So we all feel that darkness. But we also feel the light. And that's the magic of this time, that sometimes things don't make sense in real time. So I'll illustrate this for our parsha, and we'll wrap it up and go have a delicious dinner. This last parsha is the most painful parsha of all, right? Because Joseph, it's a straight descent into the abyss for Joseph. In the pit, almost killed by his brothers. Then he's sold as a slave, Joseph is. He goes down to Egypt. Little bit of success with Potiphar's house. Mrs. Potiphar attacks him and makes the accusation. He's thrown into another dungeon in a pit just to be there almost for life. And then a little bit of light comes, right? You have the Saramashim and Sarofim, you have the butler and the baker, and they come and they have their dreams clear from God. And it's you're thinking to yourself, well, I know ultimately it's going to have a happy ending. So we're waiting. Where's my happy ending, right? And the butler says, I promise, Joseph, because you gave me this interpretation, and when I get my old job back as Pharaoh's cupbearer, I will certainly remember you and get you out of this dungeon where you do not belong. And how's the parsha end? V'lo zachar. Not only does the chief butler not remember Joseph on that day, vayishkacheu, the final nail in the coffin, he forgot about him for years. And that's always the parsha, by the way, that precedes Hanukkah or is part of Hanukkah by design. That's how the rabbis designed it. And then you're thinking, but this is so unfair. oh my gosh, right? I remember teaching fourth grade. You know, if the kids don't know the story, can you imagine having a fourth grader and then you got to stop at the end of Vayeshev and they're like, going to cry, Joe, what's going to be, right? But what do you have to do? Just look a verse or two ahead. Vayehi Miketz, the parsha that we read this Shabbat, which is also always Hanukkah. The rabbis say, at the end of two full years, Pharaoh remembers Joseph through the butler's remembering. He brings Joseph and he goes from the outhouse to the penthouse. Donny Osmond gets a gig on Broadway. The Technicolor Dreamcoat. All the things are great, right? So you know what the rabbis say about that? Ketz sam lachoshech. Ketz means the end. God has placed in our world with 100% metaphysical certitude that there will be an end to this darkness. Sometimes the end is only a verse or two away and you can't see it, but then the magic starts to happen. Maybe the pagers and the walkie-talkies start to go off. Sorry, that if you don't know what I'm referring to, you can ask me after. You know, things start to happen of light, of ore in our world. And you say, oh my gosh, wow. If I just hang out a little more, if I can be a little more patient, God has promised an end to this darkness. There will be an end to this darkness. Frelige Chanukah to everyone.